Life's Third Act is a podcast dedicated to helping you get the most out of your retirement. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Life's Third Act. This week we want to look at the life and estate planning of
Leona Helmsley.
Leona Helmsley. Have you heard of Leona Helmsley? I'm willing to bet that this is one of those names, unlike some that we've done, like, Philip Seymour. I wasn't sure how many people know that. I think Leona Helmsley, we probably would get a 95% recognition among our audience.
Yes.
So many of you will remember in the 80s, she became a symbol of, I guess, the Reagan era, those who are critical of the Reagan era. But it was a time of a lot of ostentatious wealth. The 80s were a good era, actually, yeah. In many ways. It was economically is a pretty good era. And we know that the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc was coming apart. So 80s became, I think, in my mind, I'm curious to get your thoughts, it was a good era. You'll have to take my word for this.
I will, I promise.
But anyway, so Leona Helmsley and her husband, Harry, were big celebrities in New York.
Yeah.
And really internationally in the hotelier business.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you, let's talk about her success and why she was a celebrity, and then we'll get to kind of the estate planning and some other things.
Yeah, so Leona really, I mean, the biggest thing that she was known for is she's known for a bunch of things, but one big thing she was known for is she came from nothing. You know, she was born to a hat maker and her mother was a homemaker, and she didn't really, you know, have a whole lot growing up. So when she became an adult, she just really stopped at nothing to create the life that she wanted for herself.
Yeah, I think she was born in 1920.
Yeah.
So she would have been during the 30s was her formative year.
Yeah.
She would have been a teenager and really growing up,
mm-hmm.
age 10 to 20. And so that would have, I mean, the depression
yeah.
would have had an impact.
I mean, yeah, my great-grandma, I know, like, she told me tons of stories about the Great Depression. She died when she was 106. But I just, like, from her stories, from her stories, I just know, like, a lot of what it was like growing up in that time. And she was like, if you didn't have anything, you really just didn't have anything. You had to make a lot of things out of nothing. So I feel like that was kind of Leona's case. She just really, you know, she wanted more
yeah.
for herself. I feel like a lot of people did then, especially, like you said, in their formative years when they really, like, get to know the world and what's going on in it. And they probably thought, like, I don't want to do this any longer.
Yeah, yeah. This is Scout, incidentally, making some, she's complaining, I think. I don't think she's complaining about the topic. But anyway, I think she wants to get out of here.
Aww.
So, but, you know, I think that's true. And many of us know the impact that the depression has from people that in our families, some of you watching.
Yeah.
And so she was very ambitious, but she also was very fastidious about her money.
Mm-hmm.
She, even though she became fabulously wealthy, which we'll explain more in a second, she was always very tight-fisted about
yes.
money. And I think a little bit of that came from people who were raised in that era.
Oh, completely. Just, I mean, my family, you know, we don't have any kind of money like that. But, I mean, they made $10 stretch a long way. They still do
yeah.
to this day. And I'm like, wow. And they're just really tight about their money, which I understand coming from an era like that where, you know, you don't have anything. And she made it all of herself.
So tell us how she ended up successful.
Yeah, so we'll kind of start at her first marriage. She was married to an attorney for her first marriage, and she had her first son Jay with him, her only son. And then she went on to marry, she divorced him and went on to marry an executive for the fabrics industry. And she actually married him twice, divorced him twice. So after her divorce in around 1960, she was like, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. She really wanted to do something for herself. So she got her real estate license and she just kind of took it by storm. She started selling luxury condos, co-op apartments.
And this was in the 60s.
Yes. In the Upper East Side of New York. And she worked her way up to be a VP of a company, and then she worked her way up to be a president of a company, and then she met Harry Helmsley.
Strong roots are essential for a healthy tree, especially your family tree. That's why you work hard to take care of your family every day. At Tucker Allen, we know that taking care of your family means planning for the future. Our team provides personalized estate planning to help you protect your family, your legacy, and your future. From wills and trusts to long-term care and estate planning, count on Tucker Allen, personalized estate planning made simple.
She had acquired some properties.
Mm-hmm.
So she wasn't as wealthy as the person we're about to talk about, Harry, but she had acquired real estate in New York.
Yes.
And she was a mover and shaker in the real estate industry, particularly through her connections as a broker.
Yeah, she owned a couple of apartments at that time, all in the Upper East Side, which if you've ever been to New York, I'm assuming you have. It's, you know, really rich area. It's very nice.
These were buildings.
Yes, yeah. But yeah, she met Harry and kind of changed her life from there. So
they married when?
They married in 1972.
Okay.
And she was 53, he was 63, and he actually, so they started an affair prior to that, and he actually divorced his wife of 33 years to marry Leona, and she just moved up in his company. And actually, at that time, he kind of saved her and all of her money because she was getting sued by some of her tenants. And that went through, the lawsuit went through, she had to pay out. And they also took her real estate license away from her. So he put her in the business and he was like, grow this as big as you possibly can for me. And she did that.
So she really was, you know, talented. She wasn't just what the phrase that was more a 20th century phrase, a gold digger.
She
wanted the wealth, and I'm sure that was a factor. But I think events later showed that she truly loved Harry.
Yeah.
She was very devoted to Harry. They were married to his death. But she was ambitious, and she also had an ability to manage.
She had an ability to manage.
Made a lot of enemies. I guess you could argue about that. But so talk about what her reputation was, kind of taking control of this portfolio of properties. And tell us what the portfolio included.
Yeah, so the portfolio included the Empire State Building, 530 Park Avenue. 230 Park Avenue, not 530.
Fabulous property.
Yes.
Known for luxury.
Yeah. She had the Tudor City apartment, or they owned the Tudor City apartments, and then they had the Helmsley Palace Hotel, and then they had hotels all throughout the United States as well.
A number of Ritz-Carltons.
Yes.
So, I mean, it was a portfolio that by the time of Harry's death, which occurred in 97, it was, what, $5 billion?
Yeah.
Think about that. We didn't see the B in front of Ilion until the 21st century.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw some billionaires in the 20th century, but not many. And so $5 billion in 97.
To own the Empire State Building is just something I have to wrap my head around in general, let alone the $5
billion. Yeah. And she ran, though, a tight ship. And while I want you to talk about her management style, which was notorious.
Yeah.
Her hotels, you know, the trains ran on time, right?
Oh, they definitely did. She was not one for anybody messing anything up. Her management style was harsh. She didn't take any
draconian.
She didn't take any little mistake from any employee. And if she found something, she would scream at them in front of, you know, guests, in front of other employees, anything. And usually it was followed by them being fired. So, you know, like you said, she ran a really tight ship. She was at the forefront for her customers, and that is something that she ran with. So people, you know, knew her as, quote unquote, the Queen of Mean.
Queen of Mean. That once somebody dubbed that, and I don't know whether that was New Yorker magazine, but it stuck.
Yeah, it definitely did, because she was mean. I mean, it was really all for her guests, though. So I understand it in like a business sense, but also she probably could have been a bit of a better boss. But she was also, her and Harry were kind of mean in other ways. They didn't like paying people. They didn't like paying invoices. They really didn't like paying taxes. So, you know, it just kind of was through and through. But I think she had some good points as a person. But other than that, people just really saw her as mean. Even after her son died at 42. And after he died, she sued his estate for money. And then she sent an eviction notice to his widow and her son, as they were living in one of her complexes, and she kicked them out. So I think she just didn't really think about anybody but herself or Harry.
Yeah, and that story you tell is really kind of damning, in the sense that the dispute was over $240,000 in his estate. And I think she must have felt that she had been treated disrespectfully or something, because why would she go after $240,000 that would have gone to the kid, kids?
Yeah, and I don't know, like, I can't think of it in the sense of money, because she did end up giving, you know, some money to them, not a ton.
When she died.
Yeah, when she died, but I don't know. I think she just did things to make points, honestly. I think she was just one of those people that had to make a point with everybody, and she had to let everybody know, I'm the big dog. And, I mean, people knew that. People, they respected her probably out of fear a lot of the times. But, I mean, like, her guests were treated the best of the best in any of their hotels. She ran this really famous ad campaign. And it was one where it was like, you know, I wouldn't use Skippy towels, so why should you? I wouldn't sleep on hard beds, so why should you? And one of them also said, it was for the Helmsley Palace. It said, this is the only palace where the queen will stand guard at the front door. So I think she just really did it for them. And she really did it because she liked to make a show and a point.
So in a way, I guess if you're looking to travel and you want to stay at a great hotel.
Yeah.
I mean, she had cultivated this reputation of being just lashing the whip, and people thought, if you're a potential customer, you think, wow, that this everything's going to be good here. And it was.
What you want in a hotel? I mean, I don't want to go stay at a bad hotel, so nobody does. And I think she understood that. I mean, especially in the time frame that they were in, there was probably a bunch of just not great hotels for people to travel to or stay in.
But what's really troubling about her is that she's one of those, and I think there aren't a lot of those people, that when you say they have a bad reputation, you find those who are prepared to step forward and say, but. And usually that's a significant, you know, element of the people who knew them. In her case, you know, it really, you can't find anybody that's stepping forward that I can think of, that of the things I've read and things you've read.
Yeah.
She was pretty universally regarded as very tough, very driven, not having empathy
for
anybody, and being unnecessarily avaricious or parsimonious. She would fight over bills with people where it was a big deal to them. So if there was this one person who had done a lot of the woodwork in one of her houses, and he had a number of kids, and you know, four or five kids, and she knew that, and I think he may have referenced it in saying, look, I really need you to pay me.
Mm-hmm.
And she made this statement, not to him, I think, but as she walked away, someone who was there said, well, if he had kept his pants on, he wouldn't be in this position. And so she would refuse to pay people. It may be because she felt the job wasn't perfect. Let's impute that. I think that was probably generally true, that she, I'm not saying reasonably, but in her mind, she thought, this isn't quite right. Mm-hmm. And so you don't deserve this much. And but I think, quite frankly, she also was very reluctant to pay people, period. And so people knew that they'd have to haggle to get paid. And then this one incident, it's where greed brings you down. And in her case, you know, you reach too far and you lose it all. Well, she didn't lose it all, but she ended up in prison in part because she was just too greedy. Tell that story.
Yeah, so she had some contractors come out to their home, Dunnellan Hall, and
major renovation, right?
Yes, major renovations. They had purchased it, I believe, for $11 million, and they were doing about like $1 to $2 million renovation or amount. I can't talk. Around $1 to $2 million of renovations,
which is a lot of money in the '90s.
Yeah, and so they wanted, you know, like this new dance floor, and she purchased like this $500,000 jade statue and all kinds of things, and the contractors finished, and you know, they came around for their money, and she just avoided things and didn't pay them, and they started finding out that she was giving them false invoices, and she was invoicing it under their company's name so that she could write it off as a tax write-off.
As a business expense.
Yeah, and so that kind of unraveled everything for her and Harry. That kind of sent everything, you know, in a spiral. Somebody talked to, I believe it was the New York Post, and the New York Post published those invoices, and then the state of New York went after them for tax implications because they realized, oh my goodness, they haven't been paying taxes in years, and they've been avoiding a bunch of things. And then the U.S. obviously went after them also, and it was a big trial.
Yeah, there were, and this happened in the early 90s, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So there were federal charges and state charges, everything from wiretapping to extortion to tax evasion. The extortion charges related to the fact that she didn't want to pay these people until they cooperated in terms of billing appropriately, putting in something that was not legal, saying it was a business expense and submitting it to one of their businesses. Mm-hmm. So that would be extortion. And also something that she had done for years and done it with many of their contractors was that she would say, and this is with a business contractor, say to them, look, I'll give you this deal if you give me something personally. So it might be that, what would be an example? Let's say that they're having the woodwork done at the Helmsley Palace mm-hmm. Hotel. And so it may be a $10 million job to have woodwork done throughout. And she may say, look, I'll give you this bid if you do throw in doing our house and do it as a gift. So it shows as a gift for which she would not owe taxes, rather than something that's related to a business transaction.
Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't even that, like the contractors that all had like stemmed the notoriety of her not paying taxes from, that was just kind of the breaking point for her.
Yeah.
But it kind of started whenever she threw a big fit, because she didn't want to pay New York City tax or New York State tax on $40,000 worth of jewelry from Van Cleef and Arpels, which is like a big high-end jewelry brand. And she just, that's kind of just what everybody knew her for. And so I think there was suspicions leading up to it. And then when it came to the contractors, they were like, okay, well, we're just done here. Like, we're not going to play our games.
Yeah. I she was reckless in that way. Mm-hmm. And like you get, I think that's a good point, that the people first became aware that you know, maybe this is the tip of the iceberg in this incident over the jewelry. So it kind of had investigative reporters wondering. And here's the thing that I think should have been obvious to her, and it's obvious to many people, is that if you're going to conduct your life that way, where you regularly alienate and offend people and make them scratch and claw for every nickel that they've already earned, then you need to be squeaky clean.
Yes.
You need to, because you must take it as a given that these people will continually be trolling looking for opportunities to retaliate,
yes,
to bring you down. So she had created a world of those people.
Mm-hmm.
So she, that might have been, well, it's not commendable, but she might have died, you know, without having gone to prison and some of those hassles, despite how harsh and inconsiderate she was, had she been squeaky clean. But you can't conduct your life that way and on top of it, you know, have all of these Achilles heels. And there were lots of vulnerable spots. So these people that she was treating this way knew that she was breaking the law.
Mm.
And she should have foreseen that that was going to come back to bite her. So it did. And Harry apparently was deemed not capable of...
Yeah, so he, around that time, once she was indicted and they were going through court and everything, he was found not to be mentally stable. He was having seizures and his mental state was just going really far downhill. He was around 86, 87, well, no. He would
about
have been around
83.
80, yeah.
Yeah.
At that time that it was going on, so they didn't bring him in. And honestly, that just makes me wonder too if he knew about everything that she was doing, because before she got there, there was never any reports that he was doing anything illegal or anything.
Yeah,
like that.
He's not, he didn't have this reputation.
No.
She
no.
did. And you look at the problems she had before she married him with people who were tenants.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there was some cause of action that they ended up settling. You don't easily lose your real estate license.
No.
So for someone who had been so prominent in the real estate market to have lost. So I think that her modus operandi existed before she met Harry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Harry probably really loved her. There's every indication.
Yeah.
And incidentally that it was mutual. Furthermore, I mean, he prospered.
Oh.
I mean, I don't know what his portfolio was in 72, but I'm sure it was far short of $5 billion. So she was the one who was the face of the organization in many ways, and she ran a very tight ship, and I think that in many ways a very profitable ship. But,
yeah.
But man, oh man, she was so reckless in terms of being retaliatory.
Yes, yeah, and I think she really brought Harry out, if that makes any sense, just like into the public eye more, because obviously he was big. You have to be big to own the Empire State Building and, you know, all of those. But I think she just made him even bigger and introduced him to even more people. And that's how he grew his portfolio, because she loved throwing parties. She loved doing all of that thing, all of that stuff. And she liked being in the public eye. So I also wonder if she did some of this for attention or something like that. But I don't know. She, in the court trial, she also stated that she only believed that the little people should pay taxes.
Oh, that was some damning testimony.
Yeah.
In these trials.
Yeah. And so I don't know if she just, you know, was raised on that belief, or was it, she just came with it from watching her parents.
So,
I don't know.
So we're going to come to, you know, the trial and her conviction. But I want to dwell for a moment on the point that you just raised, mm-hmm. Marley, and that's that Harry and his wife of 33 years, had been very low key.
Mm-hmm.
So people in the real estate industry knew them, and yes, he was very wealthy already, very influential. I think he already owned the Empire State Building.
Yeah.
So big, but very low key. Person on the street, you stop them, they may not know that name.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody of importance in the industry and beyond would know that name. So she marries he marries Leona, and Leona, you know, introduces him to, you know, this life that's very public, spending lots of luxury. He lived humbly.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a very relatively modest lifestyle. And so she comes in, I guess she says, look, you know, we're rich and, you know, you should enjoy your wealth. And I'm sure she sold him on that, and mm-hmm. they bought a condo, this magnificent condo at the top of one of their buildings.
Yep.
Or
it overlooks Central Park. It was a penthouse with 9 rooms.
So, so she, you know, she kind of introduced him to a world of a lot of entertainment. And oddly enough, kind of like this was true to some extent for Trump, was that she made Helmsley a brand associated with perfection and luxury.
Yes.
And that, you know, we do it right here. And Trump did a little bit of that. And I guess New York must draw that sort of that sort of branding. And she did that. And it's funny that she and Trump were contemporaries, and she was a little older, but significantly older, but still they competed head to head, and boy, did they hate each other.
Did not like each other at all.
She made, what was the quote that you mentioned to me earlier?
She said, "I wouldn't trust him if his tongue was notarized."
And he said something to the effect, there are lots of quotes by both of them against each other. He said, "Look, I'm willing to forgive my worst enemy, but not Leona Helmsley."
Yeah, yeah.
So they litigated against each other a lot. They both were trying to dominate the real estate scene in New York. And so that was a good pair to be against each other.
I completely
Leona Helmsley and Trump, you know. That was a heavyweight battle.
Yes.
So anyway, let's talk about that. She goes to trial. She's convicted, not surprisingly. And what's her sentence?
Yeah, so she's indicted on 188 counts by the state and then 47 by the federal government. And she was supposed to serve 4 years, but she tried to, you know, be like, "I can't go to jail because my blood pressure will kill me, my husband will die," and the judge just didn't really care. And he was like, "No, you're just going to go for 4 years." So she went, and she only ended up serving 18 months. But she got out, and then shortly after that, Harry did pass away.
Yeah, so she got out, I think, in 94.
94, yes.
And so Harry dies in 97. Mm-hmm. Now, you should know, they create a charitable trust in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And so there was a significant amount of their wealth that was in this charitable trust that was already in existence. Harry dies in 97. She starts, you know, recognizing she's aging. He was 87 when he died. Coincidentally, she dies at 87.
Yeah.
He died in 97. She died in
2007.
Isn't that? So anyway, she sensed, though, her mortality. And she, in 2005, she creates or updates estate planning. And now remember, she has a child. She had one child who's dead now. So she has four grandkids. And apparently she only liked two of them.
Yes, yeah. She, in her updates to her will, and I'll pause really quick, she did also inherit, when Harry died, that $5 billion estate that we were talking about.
Oh, that's an important point. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. Harry left in his will, in the residuary clause, virtually all of his assets to her. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he loved her clearly.
Yeah.
And she continued to honor him in other ways. We'll talk about that here in a minute more with these grandkids.
But so she updated her will and she took out two grandkids. Nobody knew why. It's not published anywhere. And then also after Harry died, we'll talk about Trouble, the dog. She got this dog named Trouble. I couldn't find out what breed he was. He was a small dog. But she loved that dog. It was the only animal she had ever owned.
Well, she didn't care for human beings for the most part.
And I don't even think she cared for animals before him either. So,
but now she gave a lot, huge causes to animals.
She did. So I don't know if she cared to own one, though, because maybe she was so busy. But she got this dog, and everybody was like, that dog was just a human to her. Like, she took him to bed every night. She took him everywhere that she went. They were just... she was attached to that dog. And so in the updates to her will, she sets up a trust for him of $12 million.
For this dog.
For a dog.
And then what? Tell us about, she had two grandkids.
Yes.
That she did include. She had four total.
She did have the two grandkids that she did include. She willed them $5 million apiece, which... in the grand scheme of things, it's not a whole lot.
$5 million as a percentage of $5 billion. And yet these are the closest living people to her.
Yeah.
These four, there were four grandkids.
Yeah.
I mean, that was it. So that's an incredible, it's like, you know, your only child leaving a half a percent of your estate.
Yeah.
I mean, it boggles the mind. But anyway, and a little bit more about information on this is that she left it in the form of a unit trust, mm-hmm. which is not a terrible thing. A unit trust is where the payments aren't fixed that's paid out, but there's a percentage that's fixed. Mm-hmm. So if she wants to have 5% paid out per year, then it's 5% of the balance every year. So if the balance goes up because investments do well, then it's going to be more. If it goes down because investments didn't do well, then it'll be less. But it's always 5% of the balance. That's a unit trust. It's a great concept, incidentally, for a way to have money paid out. But what's interesting is she technically didn't leave the $5 million to the kids.
Yeah, no.
They get the income from the unit trust, these two grandkids, each of them from this, I don't know if it's 5%, but that's mm-hmm. a typical amount. So whatever is generated by this $5 million for each, $5 million for each, is what they'll get. But when they die, there is a charitable remainder provision. So it goes to one of the charities. It's interesting, and it's as if that were not unreasonably tight-fisted. There's an additional condition: is these two grandkids will only receive this money if they annually go visit the grave of their grandfather, mm-hmm. her deceased husband. So she wanted them to show respect, and there was actually to be a register kept, mm-hmm. which they had to sign under penalty of fraud, which it would be fraud,
yeah.
if they didn't actually show up to get this and they continued getting the money. So she was, in interesting ways, she conveyed that she cared about him and wanted him respected. So if these kids are getting this money today, I assure you, they're going at least once a year to his grave, visiting his grave and signing this register.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I thought was a little bit revealing was she wanted to be buried with her wedding ring next to her husband. And I think there's not a provision for anybody else to be near them.
No. So the only provision that was for anybody else to be near them was for Trouble the Dog.
Oh.
They built an entire mausoleum for Harry and for when they died, and she even made like a legacy provision for it of $3 million for the upkeep of that and anything else in the Helmsley name. But yeah, that was the only people she wanted buried with her.
So the bulk of her estate went to the charity,
mm-hmm.
Harry and Leona Helmsley Charity.
Yes.
There's a lot of wonderful causes that to this day are benefiting hugely. I mean, she was really concerned about healthcare, mm-hmm. health research.
Yeah, healthcare, health research. The Humane Society was a really big one for her. She, after 9/11, donated $5 million, which this was out of the trust, obviously, when she was alive. $5 million to the firefighters and police families. So, I mean, like, it's just very odd to me that like she was just. People thought of her as such a horrible person, but she really wanted to help humanity, and it was just very strange, and animals, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's one of these people, we've all known them, who like humanity in general, but no human being in particular.
Yes, yeah.
You know, like, or very few human beings in particular, and she definitely was very restrictive as to where the money went and how it was used. And the fact that there was so much money, you would have thought that there were people around her, such as a housekeeper or mm-hmm. you know, somebody who was like a butler.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody commented that she remembered to give him money, but it wasn't much. It was something very modest.
Yeah.
So you would think that somebody who hadn't just these grandkids in the world and that much money, you would think that in addition to giving a lot to charity, that they would give a lot to their family or to people, maybe not family, that they care about. For her, there was no one mm-hmm. who met that category. And even the people, the only people in the world that she would consider family, she was very reluctant to give them much.
Yeah.
She was a bizarre woman in many ways. And even toward the end, you would have thought that she would have loosened her grip a little bit on some of the money. And I even think $5 million after 9/11 is generous, but...
Yeah, I mean, in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, and I'm afraid that's what people think, is uh-huh. rather than thinking, when they know she has $5 billion at the turn of the century, and she and she lives in New York. This is her backyard. Yeah. And she gives $5 million. It just, I don't know. She's a woman that's hard to like, and not many people succeeded.
Yeah, except for Trouble, the dog.
Trouble, he did okay. Although the judge ended up, which the courts can do, when you do estate planning and you leave what's called an honorary trust, where it's a trust in which there's no beneficiary. And historically, it's not possible to have an enforceable trust with no beneficiary. That's just one of those fundamental rules going all the way back to the 15th century in England. So you would leave honorary trust, where you'd put money in trust, you'd leave it to an individual, and then you'd have this precatory, this suggestive language saying, this is what I want to happen, but it wasn't really legally enforceable. There's kind of a moral obligation. So it's called an honorary trust. Now the law actually permits you to create an enforceable trust without what would be considered a beneficiary. The dog cannot be legally a beneficiary, mm-hmm. but it can be a trust created for the dog's benefit. And you can appoint somebody who's in charge of assuring that the money goes for that benefit. So you can have an honorary trust now that's perfectly enforceable for animals as well as for non-living things like a mausoleum mm-hmm. or if you want a gravesite or certain other things that you want done. You can't have it in perpetuity. There are term limits like 21 years typically. If you're creating a trust for an animal, and most states have adopted the Uniform Trust Code's provisions on this, you can actually, if you have several animals, it's the last to die. But it can't be for an animal that's born after you die. So let's say that any animal, mm-hmm. it could be an animal that lives 80 years. Aren't there turtles or something that lives
over
100 years?
Yeah.
So you could have a trust that was in effect for over 100 years. But for a dog, what are we looking at? 10, 12? If it's more than one animal, whenever the last animal dies, then the trust ends. So if it's one dog, whenever that dog dies. But that's what she had. She had an enforceable trust, but she left more money than was necessary for that task. And the court has the discretion, as this court did. It moved some of that $12 million, I think seven of it, at least it took away and put with, I assume, her charitable trust.
And it took a portion of it and gave it to the two grandkids who were cut out of the will.
Oh.
So it took some of it to give to them. And then the breakdown of it was per year, it was $100,000 for Trouble's full-time security. It was $8,000 for grooming, $1,200 for food, which I'm really surprised the food budget wasn't more.
$1,200.
Yeah, I know. And then it was $60,000 for a guardianship fee, which went to Carla Leclerc, who was the manager of one of their hotels, who took Trouble. But I just can't even imagine $100,000 for security.
Well, and one thing I want to mention, too, is because of this was a strange will in some ways, mm-hmm. But it also was a will that, for the most part, went through a probate estate. Mm-hmm. Now, the taxes weren't what it would have been because so much of it was charitable. So this trust really didn't have a tax problem. In other words, the IRS is willing to let you give your money to 501c3 organizations that, like a school or education or to relieve poverty or healthcare. Those are kind of purposes of, and religion, are 501c3s. So there wasn't a tax problem with this estate, but it did go through probate. And that means that there were a lot of costs and a lot of money was pulled away by lawyers, accountants, executors. There were four executors, which included two of the grandsons. Yeah. One was a business manager, also was an executor, and I think a CPA or attorney was.
Yeah.
And that went on because of the size of this estate. This is one reason you don't put stuff through your estate. Is this the last submission for payment to the executors or personal representatives was $100 million, and it was in about 2019, mm-hmm. wasn't it? 2019. She died in 2007. So, I mean, in this case. Yeah, there was a lot of costs and a lot of it was eaten up, but not so much for taxes. But imagine anybody else, any of us with smaller amounts of money. Maybe ours won't be $100 million in costs, but I think you get a sense for how much expense, all the administrative hassles, all the court appearances, all the people that feed off of an estate. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's several professions that focus on the money that's made in an estate. And it's perfectly legal. It's not inappropriate. It's provided for by statute. And people doing the work have to be paid. My only argument is, if you can avoid that, you should avoid it. And you can't avoid it. That's the good news. You can avoid it with a trust you create during your lifetime.
Yeah. How common is it for people to set up like trust funds like that for pets? Not $12 million, but...
You know, I know that Tucker Allen has done several. Mm-hmm. It's becoming more common because people now their families don't all live next to them.
Yeah.
And their families tend to... There's this centrifugal force where families spread out across the continent and you're not comfortable saying to them, would you take my dog? Sometimes they don't like dogs in the house. Maybe the daughter-in-law or the son-in-law, as the case may be. It may be the reason the client feels uncomfortable naming. And it's a big ask. Mm-hmm. It's not a small ask. If you have a dog that you die and the dog has half its life ahead,
yeah.
I mean, depending on the dog, that could easily be 8 years. So, I mean... To ask somebody to have a dog, unlike a cat, some would say a cat sees you, would be harder. But I think we can all agree, any type of pet is going to be a lot of trouble. But dogs, you have to be with, you have to walk, you have to take care of. You probably cannot leave outside all the time. Mm-hmm. And particularly the sort of person that would put the dog in their will, somebody who doesn't want them.
Yeah,
they don't want their dog outside, and they want their dog well taken care of. So you can see why it is more common today than it would have been years ago.
Yeah, and I think that also has to do, because I have a dog and like she was, you know, she's been my everything for forever. And I think it has to do with just this generation as well, is like we're really big into like the fur babies and keeping like having like animals as family and so on and so forth. So I just think it's really interesting, like seeing people put them into their estates and everything like that when that wasn't super common.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I think we'll see more of that. And I would say to our viewers that because it is an imposition to just leave your pet, I think what many people find is that they don't feel like it's so much an imposition if they're willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
Then they can think of people that they would call and say, look, if I pass away, would you be willing to take care of my dog? And, oh, incidentally, let me make clear, I want this to be fully paid for. And the person, you know, can be gracious and say, no, I don't want to accept payment. And of course you insist and they do. So, I mean, I think that it really is the answer. It's the answer for dogs to be taken care of without that big ask.
Yes.
Of,
especially if you're getting $100,000 a year.
Exactly. So. Yeah. I mean, you can make it fairly generous, particularly if it's a loved one.
Yeah.
You don't give them money anyway, but you sweeten the pot. So, yeah, I think that I know we see more of it, but I think furthermore we'll see a lot more.
Yeah, I agree.
Over time. So, and I think that's the reason the Uniform Trust Code made provisions for this,
mm-hmm.
because people's animals now in America at least are more and more like family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I think it's just, you know, one of those things that we've seen so many animals just be abandoned because nobody was set in place to take them, which is really sad. And
yeah.
I wouldn't want that for any of my family members. So, you know, it's just interesting sometimes to know what to do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Trouble may, particularly if he has any of the characteristics of his owner,
yes.
he may be a handful.
Yeah. Yeah. He unfortunately passed away in 2010, but I can only imagine.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. But the reason they hired the security too, I forgot to go into this, was because they were getting death threats because the dog was willed $12 million. So it's just crazy. That's just unimaginable to me.
I guess the trustee could, if there were a ransom demand, I guess the trustee would be justified. It'd be his duty,
yeah.
a fiduciary duty to pay... to get it the beneficiary, quote unquote, back. So anyway, I hope you found this interesting. I found this interesting because I didn't know a lot of this about Leona Helmsley. So I'm glad, Marley, you suggested this.
Yeah.
It was a great topic.
Thank you.
Till next time, this has been another episode of Life's Third Act. Take care.
You've been listening to Life's Third Act, a podcast for thriving in retirement. sponsored by Tucker Allen, your estate and elder law advisors. Each week, we discuss topics and answer questions to help you better plan for your future. For more information, visit TuckerAllen.com. Subscribe and listen again next week for another edition of Life's Third Act. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.
To get it the beneficiary, quote unquote, back. So anyway, I hope you found this interesting. I found this interesting because I didn't know a lot of this about Leona Helmsley. So I'm glad, Marley, you suggested this.
Yeah.
Was great topic.
Thank you.
Till next time, this has been another episode of Life's Third Act. Take care.
You've been listening to Life's Third Act, a podcast for thriving in retirement. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, your estate and elder law advisors. Each week, we discuss topics and answer questions to help you better plan for your future. For more information, visit TuckerAllen.com. Subscribe and listen again next week for another edition of Life's Third Act. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.